Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Action Park Media.
Hi, I'm Ethan Suplee. Welcome to American Glutton. Outside of acting, my two favorite things to do are diet and eat. I have a very complicated relationship with food, and on this podcast, we're going to talk about all of it. Food as entertainment, food as sport, food as fuel. I'll talk to experts and the average person, just like you and me.
I hate to ask you to do anything, but if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to like, subscribe, rate, review, all of the above on whatever app you're getting it from. Today on American Glutton, I'm talking to Thomas DeLauer. Thomas is an author and performance coach who went from a 280-pound corporate executive to losing over 100 pounds and being on the covers of health and fitness magazines worldwide. Thomas has a real interesting take on how to follow a ketogenic diet. And today we are talking about that, the microbiome, and a bunch of other things in between. You can find him on Instagram at Thomas DeLauer. Thomas DeLauer, welcome to the American Glutton Podcast.
Awesome, man. Thanks for having me. This is great.
Your trip from where you were at to where you are now is fucking wild and so impressive. What were you doing? Like, what in your head back when you were doing investments?
I was in the healthcare world, so I was an executive recruiter, and then I was in like ancillary lab services, the private equity world.
But like business, you were a businessman.
Yeah.
And was there any thought at that time about health? Did you look the way you look now as a kid?
No. So as a kid, I was super skinny. And I was like a long distance runner, a super nerdy cross country, you know, like that kind of thing. Actually, the polar opposite of, you know, what I kind of am now. And I just beat the crap out of my body running so much. That's really kind of the story. I blew out my knees by the time I was like 15. It was just from running so much. So, I definitely didn't look like I look now. I was pretty emaciated. Just kind of.
I always wonder these things because I I want to go like in my head. I want to rationalize everything. I want really. It's not judgmental, but it's like, how hard is this guy working? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I think like if a guy like you looked the way you do at 19 and then gained weight and then lost it, I'm just trying to go like, did his body remember this, or you literally went from being an obese person to being as fit as you could be?
Yeah, I went from, I mean, it was like a serious Alice in Wonderland type thing. I went from being super skinny to being super fat. And then it was kind of one of those things where, okay, while I was fat, it was a perfect opportunity to build some muscle while I was there, right? I mean, so that was kind of my thought process is, okay, while I'm trimming down, I've got this extra clay mass, might as well try to build something out of it. And I mean, make no mistake, I mean, I worked out when I was younger. I mean, I worked out in high school, I worked out in college. I had a decent foundation. I wasn't big by any stretch of imagination. I played a winger in rugby, so I was, you know, the skinny guy.
Right.
But I knew how to work hard, you know. So make no mistake, it wasn't, I don't want to make it seem like I was like some sloppy obese person. I was a person that went from being an athlete to still eating like an athlete when I was working in a high stress, sedentary corporate setting.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the story of a lot of people, right? They just, oh, I don't know what happened. I was an athlete in college and all of a sudden, you know.
And this is something I also think about a lot. When I look at obese people and when I think about myself as an obese person, I always am also thinking about how much extra lean tissue we have just to support the adipose tissue.
Yeah.
And I go like, the opportunity to retain that muscle and to have more muscle mass than average is also right there to every, pretty much mostly anybody who's obese.
Yeah.
It often makes me like, I don't think everybody has to be muscular the way you are, or the way I am. But I know that when I went from my biggest to my smallest and I looked like I had wasting disease or something like that, and I was really in such a deep caloric deficit that I wasn't retaining much muscle mass, I was unhappy.
Yeah.
It wasn't the result I wanted, and so I think when I look at you and what you advocate for and your plans and stuff like that, I'm like, that's so awesome, because just the idea of losing a bunch of weight and retaining some muscle or building muscle is not really part and parcel with mainstream diet plans.
No,
you
no.
know?
No, not at all. I mean, I've really advocated. I've the pendulum kind of swings with what I get into, and I've gone from being sort of a dogmatic, this is what worked for me, to much more of a, well, now that I'm in much more of a maintenance mode, it doesn't make sense to have a dogmatic approach, because what works for me is being what I call metabolically flexible, doing a little bit of everything. I've been just hammered before because I experimented with plant-based. I've been hammered because I experimented with carnivore. And now I self-experiment on myself. And you know what? I get the best results I've ever had in my entire life by experimenting and doing different shit.
Yeah, that's amazing. I didn't know you did plant-based. What was that?
Yeah,
like?
I did it for like a month. I mean, it was...
And we're talking full vegan?
So vegan keto.
Whoa. So like lots of avocados extreme. and coconut oil.
Yeah, ridiculously unsustainable as far as prep was concerned.
Right.
Ridiculously unsustainable. But, I mean, and again, I probably will get just destroyed for saying this. I have to say, I felt great. I lost a crap load of muscle during that period of time. Mentally, I felt pretty good. My complexion, if you look back at like the videos when I did it, I was like gray. So I was clearly missing some stuff. I did feel good, but what's kind of funny is a lot of the plant-based community will say that, well, I feel great, but they don't always look good.
Yeah.
I
don't think anybody should get pushback on any of this stuff, because I think the only time I know what you're saying. I know this kind of stuff happens and people feel very strongly about stuff, but like, unless you're not making a moral claim for anyone.
You're, and
I've watched your stuff. You're not saying this is the only way to lose weight, you know, or even the best way. You're saying this was my way. This is what I found to be workable. I don't think that should ever be a problem.
No. Well, I agree. And I think it comes down to your passion, right? So I advocate for the most part within my life. I enjoy intermittent fasting and I enjoy cyclical keto. Why? Because I fucking like it.
Yeah.
Like, it's, and do I enjoy the research on it? I sure as hell do. But does that mean that a calorie doesn't matter? Of course not. Like,
right.
I mean, I still have logic with all of this, and I still believe that, you know, the nice thing about keto that I appreciate is that it's a, you know, a perpendicular diet that can intertwine with lots of different things. You can do, you know, vegan keto, you could do carnivore keto, you could do, you know, whatever. So there's a lot of different protocols that you can kind of intertwine with it. So I find for me, it just works really well, and I enjoy talking about it. But make no mistake, that doesn't mean that I think that's the only way to do it. I just enjoy it.
Yeah, I definitely also had the feeling on keto, like if I was going to Europe or something like this, or just pick a different restaurant, it's fairly easy, I think, to you know, take the bun off a burger or take the pita off a shawarma or something that. You know what I mean? Whereas, honestly, the way I kind of do lower fat right now, when I'm at a restaurant, I'm like, that must be poached, no oil. And then I don't always trust the people. You know what I mean? Where keto, I think you have a larger range of options. You know, you go to an airport, I can find food to eat, but when I was doing keto, I never really had to think too far ahead. You know, any sandwich, I know I can figure out the keto nature of it. So I think that's totally makes sense to me.
Yeah, you nailed it, because I always tell people, like, when the nice thing about keto, if you're traveling, is yes, you have just that luxury. When you are trying to keep it very clean carbohydrate, the issue you run into is you're not going to find a sweet potato vending machine at the airport.
Right.
So then you're going down this, okay, cook me that rice, but make sure there's no oil in it. And
that, like, let's be honest, you go to a restaurant, there's going to be oil in it.
There's oil in everything. You know what I mean? And it's usually, you know, soybean, you know, garbage oil that doesn't make you feel too good. But it's just like, if you end up thinking about it too much, you become this like orthorexic kind of sick mentality that is just as bad as being obese. Yeah. It's like you just go in the other direction. And so you have to do what works for you. And it's just being able to, even from a mitochondrial standpoint, like what happens within the cell, like you have to be able to allow that cell to adapt to different fuel sources. Like there are long tail studies with the ketogenic diet where, okay, if you do keto for too long without exposure to consuming some dietary carbohydrates, you develop less insulin sensitivity. Why? Because the cell's never having a fucking opportunity to utilize glucose as well. So of course it's going to, if you don't use it, you lose it, right? So I always, if you're going to do keto, you need to be strict about making sure that you are taking time off, unless you're doing it for therapeutic reasons, unless you're doing it, you know, there are many people, you know, epileptics, things like that, different neurodegenerative diseases that I absolutely think, yes, okay, stay strict. There's a different mechanism of action there. But, you know, you have to, if keto is your choice, like it is for me, because I like how I feel cognitively, sometimes it takes more effort for me to say, and more discipline to be like, okay, I have to come off, and I have to come off for 4 weeks, and it might be hard for a little while because there's transition period, but I'll thank myself later. My results end up, you know, being much better that way.
Right. Yeah, that's amazing. I never got that deep into it and understanding it. I think it was just that I wasn't being responsible for myself when I did keto. I was just going like, as long as I don't eat carbs, I can eat whatever I want.
Yeah.
And this is not the case, you know. Taking pork rinds and heavy whipping cream and cream cheese and making bagels and putting bacon and American cheese on them. This is not, and eating a bunch of that, right? This is not the way to lose weight. And that was really my main focus, was I just want to lose weight, right? I just want to figure this out. And so once I started to really look at my behavior and so associated with food and how I ate, it just became like, oh, I can eat this other stuff. I'm not having a secondary problem that I'm dealing with. It's really just me. But I think whatever gets you there is valid.
No, I totally agree. And it's a lot of times the root issue still rears its ugly head.
Sure.
Right. I mean, I see countless times, and let's be realistic, there's a lot of people that have struggled with their weight, have struggled with obesity. They don't have the same results that I have with keto. Let's be real. But they might have equal or better results with something else. It doesn't mean that one is better than the other. It just means that maybe they're not addressing the root issue, right?
Right.
And what I liked about keto for me is it gave me the mental wherewithal to come to terms with that. I still to this day say I like keto because of how it makes my brain feel. And because of how my brain feels, I make better dietary decisions. If I felt as clear in my brain on carbs as I do on keto, I would absolutely go to carbs.
Yeah.
It's not a question of that. It is better for my DNA, if you want to call it that, because it wires my brain better. I'm better to make decisions that really work for me. I mean, yes, there's, you know, you can count all the research surrounding histone deacetylase and all the, you know, genetic stuff. But really, I mean, if you get down to it, if you dig into the research, you could probably find something to support eating a dog turd, too.
Right. Yeah, this was this is the funniest thing, because I've been thinking lately about the how invested in quote unquote science people get. And the idea that science has some opinion on what we should be doing, when science tells you what is, and how we use it is up to us, yeah. Right? And so, you know, there's a scientific reason that we have speed limits. Somebody did scientific calculations to go like, how do we, whatever their intent was, and they came up with this thing. Does everybody never break the speed limit? Is this, you know what I mean?
That's like, a good point.
And when you do, are you doing it going like, I'm putting everyone's life at risk? And if you do that, are you an evil, bad person, right? All of this is just to say, like, and then to your point, like, salt is bad. Salt is good. You need salt. Salt's poison. I think about salt a lot simply because I think for the most part, what we knew mainstream about salt turns out to have been a bunch of bullshit.
Dude, no, you know? Shit. Yeah, totally.
And now I'm reading something else where, like, salt can affect your immune system. Everything's immune system now. And I'm like,
well, yeah, duh. I mean, it's going to be marketable, right?
Yeah. You know what's good for the immune system? Not eating too much and exercising. That's really 100%. Good for, but that's not being really pushed on people, because you have to, you know, McDonald's lobby spends a lot of money.
Yeah, 100%, man. And that's where you look at, I mean, again, it's where's the research coming from? Where are the, I mean, it's, they're just people, right? It's just like, there's people that are conducting these studies. It's just organizations that have, I hate the word agenda, so I don't even want to say that, but they have some motives. They have their own thought processes that they want to reinforce or validate. They're just humans, just like how we walk through life validating our own, you know, insecurities and whatever. So, you know, when you look at, I've been on an interesting kick lately thinking about sleep, because it's gotten me to that same thing. Like, who's the jackass that said we need exactly 8 hours?
Right.
I'm kind of curious, because there's days where I sleep 4 hours and I am a fucking rock star the next day. There's days where I sleep 8 hours and I'm a total piece of crap. Like, so I'm like, that's not a magic number. So is the whole 8 hours of sleep thing going to be like the food guide pyramid, where like all of a sudden everyone's like, what the, like 12 servings of grains, like anyone with eyes can see that's not realistic and not exactly the best choice. But we're getting there, and I think we are, right? Because now we're starting to see like, oh, sleep efficiency is important. And you know, so then
is
now,
that the food pyramid really says 12 servings of
like
grains?
Like, yeah, it's
you know, I know it's the foundation.
Yeah.
It's like bedrock. This is what you start your diet on, grains. It's, and then everything else builds from there.
Yeah.
12 like servings fats is
and,
a lot.
You know, fats and oils sparingly, you know, and it's like, I mean, a lot of that's been flipped on its head. And I'm not just saying that as a, you know, an advocate for keto. Like, I think, you know, even realistically, like looking at a Mediterranean approach that still consumes a decent amount of carbohydrates, you know, moderate amounts and, you know, lower levels of gluten coming in from their diet, because they're getting a lot more amaranth and quinoa and things like that. So I think that definitely needs to be reevaluated. And I don't think with the food guide pyramid that it's anybody's ill will. Like, I really don't. Like, in working,
you don't think that we had an abundance of wheat at some
point? Oh, yeah, I totally do. Okay. I totally do. I just think right now the reason it's changing. In my work with the like U.S. Special Forces and with the military, like, I know firsthand, like, it takes so much to drive bureaucratic change. And it's not that I don't think they're sitting there thinking, like, let's continue to pummel 10 to 15 servings of bread on these people. I think the amount of time it takes to actually have serious change with that, we vastly underestimate. And everything else takes priority, right? Like, everything right now focus on immune system in other areas and how can we get the short-term effect. So everything dietary is always going to take a back seat. Are there agendas? I think there's some money at play for sure. And what's interesting when you look at the whole like gluten thing, and I'm not going to demonize gluten, but when you look at the data, what's interesting is it's not necessarily the gluten that is getting worse, it's our consumption of the gluten that is starting to trigger somewhat of an intolerance, right? So if you look at frozen Sarah from the 1950s, where they saw, okay, well, people could actually consume gluten with out almost any instance of celiac, almost any instance of intolerance, right? Okay, you take that same frozen sera and expose it to, you know, today's wheat. Okay, it doesn't have the same effect. I mean, it has the same effect, right? So it doesn't matter whether it's people from the 1950s then. But if you expose the gluten from the 1950s to people now, they have a result, like a change.
Right.
So the point with that is that we've changed. We've had, call it epigenetic, whatever. We have had a change because of the overconsumption of something. Granted, yes, wheat is different, sure. And there's, you know, mass produced and are there Roundup in it and whatever. Yeah, of course, we can go down that. But overconsumption of something is definitely bad. And I think we're going to start to see that now with like tapioca, right? Like tapioca is in everything. How long is it going to be before we start seeing people develop resistance and intolerances to tapioca? It's like if you go out and you consume nothing but watermelon for the next like 2 years, you're probably going to start to develop some weird reaction to watermelon, right?
Yeah, this has been shown in my favorite study that shows how immediately our DNA can change is the and there can be some argument that this is just a theory or not conclusive or whatever, but if you look at the Dutch hunger winter study where there was a famine in Europe, I think it was the 1940s, the children that were either in utero at the time or very young all developed like a predisposition for excess fat, diabetes, like a whole bunch of stuff simply because their genes changed because their parents starved to death.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a pretty immediate, that's not like, you know, somebody was saying like, we haven't evolved enough to eat bread. And I'm like, I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
I think we can probably evolve to eat anything pretty quickly,
yeah.
But you know, shifts can happen immediately, generation to generation. And I don't know if it's because, you know, historically famine is so prevalent that we're accustomed to rapid changes with regard to that. I don't know, but yeah, I think the American diet is not what I would call healthy.
No.
And so, and it's been getting kind of steadily more and more unhealthy just in my lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what effect that could, I mean, it must be having some effect. You can look at it at the rate of obesity. When I was a little fat kid, there were not very many other little fat kids.
Yeah.
There are a ton now.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And it's so wild when you look at just the quality of food is changing in the sense that like hyper palatability, everything is at the forefront now. So even in an effort to create quote unquote better for you foods, they're still missing the point of like what triggers us to eat more and what triggers us to overeat. And it's at that point when you can cross this threshold and say, yes, I mean, at that point, it's a very clear as day calories in, calories out conversation. The hyper palatability of the stuff that is in our food now, even if it's, look at the keto industry. I pick on my own group there, right? It's like, I mean, hyper palatable, super sweet keto cookies, everything's savory. I get it. Like, yeah, bring some reality into life for people that are doing keto that want to have some sweet stuff. Totally get it. But you're still triggering that same kind of just conditioning and dopamine response that triggered the addiction to food in the first place. So I think the hyper palatability, so even though we are in some ways trying to get away from some of these like unhealthy things, in an effort to do that, we're getting more and more and more processed. And I think that's where we're really going to run into an issue. And what's so funny is 10 years ago when I first started keto, before it was ever like, you know, what it is right now, it was so easy to lose weight on keto because what happened when you went keto is by default, you ate whole fucking foods.
Right.
Right? Like I would eat high quality cheese. I would eat chicken. I would eat beef. I would eat eggs. I would eat butter. I would eat... But I wasn't...
There wasn't a lot of sneaky shit going on back then. I remember the first time I did Atkins, it was a lot of steaks.
Yeah.
That was my main source of fuel. And if I cut to my most recent iteration of keto, which is still years ago, it was like keto pancakes, keto bagels, keto ice cream, keto cookies, like all this stuff to the point where I was just like, this is fucking weird. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. None of this is good, healthy food.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, it's a lot of it ends up being more processed because, again, they're just trying to appeal to the masses. So it's
I'd order pizzas and just eat the top of a pizza. Yeah. And I don't even think that's so healthy.
No, I mean, well, it's better than a lot of the weird concoctions that are out there right now. Right. I mean, it really is. Like
smashing pork rinds to make like this weird flour and mixing it with a little almond flour. I've done that. In my mind right now, it's pretty bizarre.
Yeah. No, it definitely is. And it's, I mean, that's why I feel like when you can rotate and you can go through some different dietary protocols or patterns and A, find what works for you, but B, like, let's just jump to something that's totally wild, the microbiome for a minute. And like, that is full disclaimer. Like, we are so just scratching the tip of the iceberg with that, like just barely the surface. So right now, the general theme with the microbiome is they lean back on diversity is best. Okay. And the reason that they say that is because we don't know enough about one individual strain to say that one is good, one is bad.
And there's a shitload of strains.
Oh my God, dude, it's fucking ridiculous. So it's like, there's a few that are heavily studied, Bacteroidetes, Firmicutes, which are largely, Bacteroidetes, more healthy individuals, Firmicutes, more obese and things like that. There's some pretty, again, strong correlations, but that doesn't equal causation, right? So yes, they default to, okay, diversity is best. But what's so wild is like, when you look at every time you change your diet, the change in your microbiome and that adaptation that occurs, it's called the hormetic curve, which I'm sure you're familiar with. I mean, you have a hormetic stressor to a certain degree, obviously triggers an adaptation in which you build more resilience and you get stronger and you get better. Your new baseline is higher. And then there's a very sharp drop off with that hormetic curve. You know, it's curve, 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 and then a very fine line between where that hormetic curve is too much. Let's just use.
And this is when the diet is too consistent or for
too
long?
No, it's more so, I'm going to make getting to a point about like when you change the diet. Okay. And using an example of like sort of that hormetic curve, you know, if you were to have a bunch of cold exposure to try to build resiliency, right? Like Wim Hof style stuff. Well, to a certain point, that's going to be great and you're going to get stronger. But to a certain point, you trigger so much reactive oxygen species and so much stress in your body that just like anything, it becomes very toxic, right?
Right.
So same kind of thing, like if you were to sit in a sauna at 250 degrees, maybe for a few minutes, you're actually building some resiliency. But if you start doing that for an hour every day, you're going to beat yourself up and you're going to get sick, right?
Yeah.
Just like anything. Well, the microbiome has this weird effect. When you switch, you know, dietary patterns, the microbiome changes tremendously in an adaptation, right? You have different fuels, different fibers, different things like that, which is very, very good. But it's also triggering a stress on your body that is good, a stress that allows your body to adapt. Again, adapting to glucose, adapting to fats. I am all about just how do we get as widely and just diversely adapted as we can? Like, our goal isn't to be like, I want to be the best possible bacon eater that I can eat. Right. So my body just thrives on bacon. Well, I go from this thought process of, well, fuck, what happens if we run out of bacon?
Yeah.
Like, then I'm going to suck. You know, yeah. I don't want to just be dependent on bacon. Again, extreme analogy. But I want to know that, you know, I look at this from like a tactical side of things. Like, how do I get through life in the most efficient and just streamlined way possible where I'm just my best self upon all different avenues? You know, I don't want to be the keto guy that eats a sandwich with bread and then feels like crap for 3 days. That's not exactly efficient. Okay.
Right.
Granted, I want to have the discipline to not be able to eat that sandwich if I wish. But the point is that I want to be able to also be able to eat that and thrive on it. And it's kind of coming back from that aerobic anaerobic analogy of like an endurance runner that's so conditioned for endurance but never trains on any hills. So he never has the ability to go anaerobic. He's like running flat, 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 and he's fast as hell running flat. But as soon as he hits a hill, he's gassed, right?
Yeah.
I don't want that. I want to be good at both. And I want to have the ability to switch gears really quick too. And you have to switch up your foods if you want to do that, plain and simple.
Yeah, I think that's really necessary in this day and age, especially with how mobile we are. And you know, I really like my routine, my schedule, my structure. And honestly, whenever it gets disrupted, it's almost devastating, you know, when you throw something new at me and it's like, God, I have to react. I actually try to disrupt it on purpose in this way. I think it's what you're talking about is like Talib Nassim Talib, whatever. The guy who wrote Black Swan, Antifragile.
Yeah, yeah.
He talks about Antifragile and how people, and there is a point like, yeah, too much and you break, right? but none of it, and you're then fragile. Where yep. if any of this thing hits you, yep. you break.
Yep.
So you want a little bit. You yep. want to get stronger. This is how we get stronger.
Yep.
It's the same thing with lifting weights. This is all the same principle.
It's all the same principle, and we are, and that's why I have this almost just conflict of just morals in some of society right now, where it's like everything is designed to make things easier, and I'm just like, I get it. But like, why are we wanting things to be easier? Like, how far do we go with getting easy before we are WALL-E in the movie WALL-E?
Right.
Where we're just sitting there, a blob. Like,
we're pretty close to that.
We're
now.
Very close
yeah,
to that.
Our big gulps and our little people movers.
Yeah. It's getting there. And it's like, I make a concerted effort to make things more difficult, not because I want to be a tough guy, but because I just feel like that's how we're going to stay alive.
Yeah.
And like, I don't want to live to be 200 years old if it means that I'm living like WALL-E in a people mover. Like, yeah. That's not what
I want.
It
doesn't seem fun.
No.
No, it's, I mean, that's, that aspect of the movie was like a horror yeah. movie, you know?
Yeah.
It was really depressing. What a great movie, by the way.
Seriously.
WALL-E.
Yeah.
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 Such a bleak look at the future possibility. What was your first change? What was the thing that you put into place that got you on this path?
Yeah, I mean, outside of mindset, outside of, you know, kind of the education piece, I've always been a believer that, you know, you have to just believe in what you're doing. I don't believe in blind following the blind. I had to do a lot of research myself and make sure, fortunately, just the industry that I was in, I had a lot of awesome kind of out-of-the-box physicians that were like, would think like that. So kind of helped me out in learning. But you know, the first step that I did, I was like, okay, well, the easiest way for me to reduce the amount of food that I eat is to literally skip one damn meal. So before I ever got introduced to keto, I was doing intermittent fasting without really doing intermittent fasting. I was like, I'm just going to start skipping lunch was the main thing. I actually skipped lunch, and I was like, I'm going to go breakfast, and then I'm going to have this long ass gap between, you know, breakfast and dinner. And I lost like 15 pounds in like 2 weeks doing that.
Wow.
I mean, it was just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then I realized, okay, well, actually, I'm actually doing something called time-restricted feeding. At the time, there wasn't even a whole lot calling it intermittent fasting. Like, it was just various forms of caloric restriction in the research. Intermittent fasting came into the research because people were talking about it. But time-restricted feeding has obviously been around for a while, and which is intermittent fasting. Let's just call it what it is.
Right.
You're basically measuring the eating window versus measuring the fasting window. That's like the only difference, right?
Yeah.
So then I said, okay, well, let me compress things a little bit more. And then, you know, what came over me was just this huge surge of just mental acuity. And the company that I was with at the time was going through an acquisition, and it was an extremely stressful time. And I was like, wow, this is actually making me alert and making me focused and what's going on. And then I realized, okay, what's happening is this whole ketone thing. I'm like, okay, well, now let me take that, you know, one or two meals that I'm eating in this compressed period of time, and let me see what happens if I make those meals higher calorie but cut the carbs out. And then it was like, I felt friggin' unbelievable. So then it was a runaway train. I mean, it really was a runaway train, to the point where I probably started going too far and got a little obsessed. But I think you've been there.
Yeah, I've been there. For me, I just don't think I ever understood carbs. You know what I mean? When I first started dieting, I it was just incredibly restrictive, and all of the most success I ever had on a diet, it was just like, I get 500 calories a day, or yeah. and I'll lose weight, and I'll lose weight fast, and I can do this, I can suffer through it. And then my understanding of carbs was that I had some intolerance to them, and when I eat kind of I'm not talking about sugar. Sugar is a little bit different. But if I eat my carbs before and after the gym, I feel great.
Mm-hmm.
If I save them for nighttime, I don't feel great the next day. And so I just look at, like, how am I using this stuff,
yeah.
right? And if I'm in the gym and drink a Gatorade, it's fine.
Yeah.
I feel fine. I yep. actually feel a little, like, I'm a little stronger, which yeah. is wild. If I drink a Gatorade at night, I wake up hungover the next
yeah,
day.
Right.
So this is just like me going, I can use this stuff in a sane way. I also, you know, I wasn't nothing when I was really doing damage to myself. None of it was kind of clean and pointful food. I wasn't sitting down to eat 4 baked potatoes and 3 steaks.
Yeah.
I was eating fast food, which is like, I don't know how they get such calorically dense food, but there's got to be like hundreds of calories just in the bun of this shit. You know, there's sugar in the meat and everything is like, you know, on steroids or high heights. It's like on meth. You know, like you picture like when I make a cheeseburger at home, which I make occasionally, I'm like, wait a second. I got this cheeseburger for 250 calories and it's delicious and it's fine and I don't feel like shit. But the Carl's Jr. cheeseburger has 700 calories. Yeah. I don't understand this.
No, it's so weird, man. It's like, and I've seen so many people get confused and hit roadblocks because of that. Because if I were to suggest on a video that someone make a burger at home, they think that it's going to be that same 700 calorie Carl's Jr. burger.
Yeah.
And it's like, I see it in the comments. I see it. It's like, wow, like that is so, I wouldn't even think that that would cause that disconnect with people, but they see that. And in some ways it's weird because they started putting calories on the menus, at least in California, like fast food, which illuminated it for people that were aware, but it actually created this weird barrier for other people where I think they just resigned to the fact that this is what they eat. And okay, that's fine, because if I make this burger at home, it's going to be just as much calories and it's twice as much work. So fuck it. I'm just going to do the one that doesn't require the work.
Right.
I'm like, no, if you make it at home, you have a choice of what meat you can use. You can go with a 93% lean. And that's a big, you know, digression, different topic for a different day. But I mean, one of the quickest ways to change your calories is go from an 85 to a 93 meat.
Dude, dude. I mean, the patty's gigantic. It's red on the inside. Yeah. I mean, when I did that, I was like, oh my God, I got a 250 calorie burger.
Yep.
It's gigantic. It's delicious. Yeah. Ground sirloin or something like that. Heck, you know, it's fantastic. But yes, I know. I'm not shitting on fat. I'm not. When I first went and started doing quote unquote low fat on my own, I actually went too low fat, and that wasn't good.
Yeah,
that was
too.
That was not the way to do it. I felt like shit.
Yeah.
And so, it really is like, to be perfectly honest, the only thing I still actively count every day is my grams of carbohydrates.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much the same way I was doing keto. Yeah. I just get a little bit more now, and my meat choices are a little bit leaner. And that's pretty much how I live my life.
Dude, you know what I found is some of the best results that I have gotten are when I go from being very, very fat adapted, using fats all the time, high fat, low carb keto, and then transition into, okay, I'm going to go lower fat, moderate carbohydrate, still high protein. Some of the best results I get in a short amount of time are in that transitional period. And, well, there's two reasons. One, I mean, caloric density changes dramatically. All of a sudden, the volume of food is different, right? Because fats being 9 calories per gram, I mean, it's the volume of food is less.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you're eating sweet potatoes, which is twice as much volume of food. Now, granted, there's cravings that come with the blood sugar potential roller coaster ride, whatever. Yeah. The thing is that body composition wise, like my stomach and the distensibility, like it can't even accommodate that. So I get full 3/4 of the way through sweet potatoes and chicken.
Yeah.
And that, and also it kind of begs the question when you look at, you know, something called PPAR, I don't want to get super molecular and biochemy, but you know, if you're doing keto for a long time and you're very fat adapted, there is a lot of evidence that shows that your cells preferentially use whatever you've been giving it the most of, right? So if you've been feeding it a lot of fat, of course, from an evolutionary standpoint, it makes sense that it's going to adapt and start accommodating mitochondrial machinery to utilize that fat better because it's just trying to build efficiency. And then all of a sudden, you're like giving it carbohydrates and depriving yourself of dietary fat. Well, it's going to still be seeking out fat. So it's going to start pulling from your adipose tissue because in that short interim period before it transitions and builds up glucose tolerance again, it's kind of fucking panicking, right? It's like, oh shit, I need some fats, but you're not giving me fat, so I got to pull them from somewhere. So I always get like this insanely positive response. And I mean, granted, feel a little brain foggy when it's happening because that's kind of but the point is that like that transition and going periodically low fat is so important, I personally think, for body composition, but also just for adaptation. And I have been just reamed by my own keto community within that, because like
I've anti-carbs.
It's like, come on, guys. Or like talking about periodically going low fat, even within a ketogenic protocol. Like, guys, like, don't stop being so married to your fat. Like, your fat is great. Right. It's so important. I get it. I totally get it. But like, you realize that that is where you're overdoing your calories. It's pretty clear as day. Like, you're eating fat bombs, you're, you know, making these 400 calorie little truffles, or you're having, you know, keto coffee or bulletproof coffee, which is like 600 calories.
This is the only thing that is a little bit of a gripe for me with keto, is when somebody's like, you don't have to worry about how much you're eating. And I'm like, look, I didn't find that to be true.
Yeah.
That's not what the evidence suggests.
No, it's not true.
You know, if you're eating 5,000 calories a day, and you're not using them, you're not going to lose weight.
100%. You know?
Even 100%. If, like, even if you're depleting your system of glycogen and the scale is going down, I guess technically you're losing weight, but is that the weight you want to be losing?
No.
And then that's going to adjust, and you're probably going to gain weight.
Yeah.
Like, that to me is the one, and people become very dogmatic on this point of like, it doesn't matter, I'm not eating carbs, I can eat whatever I want. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't think that's true.
Yeah, no, it's not. Definitely not true. And it's just, and also the, you know, eat fat to burn fat. Like, that sends the wrong message. I get where that came from.
Right.
Like, I get it. Like, again, you know, sort of, I guess the priming, if you want to call it that, you know, of getting the cell fat adapted. But like, where on earth did someone think that you could consume 300 calories of fat that it would magically make you burn 400 calories of fat?
Right. Yeah. At some point, in order to get the adipose tissue, you got to be withholding a little bit, right? Yeah. Like, that's the way that works.
Totally, man. I just so happen to at least feel with myself that when I am keto, I don't lose the fat or get the change in body composition during my actual strict, like, maintenance calorie keto mode. I get the body composition change when I go from that mode and then put myself into a deficit.
Yeah.
Like, it's that building that shock and building that baseline, and then shock, acute stressor. Just like, you know, coming back to this again, that hormetic stressor. You have to have an acute stressor. And coming back to like intermittent fasting, same kind of problem. And I'm just being real here. It's like, you should not be fasting every day. Like, fasting should be the anomaly. It should be an acute stressor. It should be that your body building a stress response to just that, a stressor. If you do it every fucking day, that's not a stressor anymore. That's daily life.
Yeah.
You know, and of course your metabolism is going to adjust to that. It's, if you're eating 1,600 calories a day, you would be a messed up individual if your body didn't adapt to that. It's going to adapt. So I sound pessimistic with this, because I love intermittent fasting because it's probably the quickest injection of just caloric deficit that you can get. And sure, there are a bunch of other benefits, but I think most of the benefits that I speak to are lifestyle benefits, ease, things like that. You know, it's just easy as a dad to like, I just don't have to worry about breakfast, whatever, you know.
Yeah, but even anecdotally, I've had my buddy Kevin Smith, I talked to him, and he was doing intermittent fasting, and he found that he was still gaining weight. Because he would just go like, well, in my window, I can eat whatever I want. And he was able to cram enough calories in that he wasn't losing weight. And so he had to even restrict from there. Yeah. And I have had a few friends who would say, like, it doesn't matter. As long as I only eat for 4 hours, I can eat 10,000 calories, which I think is really hard for a normal person to consume that much in 4 hours. That's a lot of food. Yeah. But in theory, they were saying, like, I'm going to eat cake and this and this and eat all this stuff and eat more calories than my body could possible. But autophagy and this word and that word. Yeah. And it's like, I'm sorry. I don't think look, if there's a magical person out there that it works for, they're an outlier.
Yeah.
And this is not what people should be advertising.
Yeah, I agree. I think that getting excited about the science and getting excited about the research and how the body works is what leads to adherence for a lot of people. And that's what I'm all about, is building excitement and passion. And I feel like that's what I try to do. Like, I try to articulate subject matter in a way that gets people excited. You know, admittedly, like, earlier in my career, I feel like I was probably too dogmatic on what worked for me, you know, and probably even misconstruing science to a point where, I shouldn't say misconstruing the research, but misconstruing how I articulated it to support my own success, like what I had, well, this is why it worked. And, you know, as time has gone on and I've just gotten a chance to work with amazing people and amazing high performers and amazing military personnel that, you know, really dedicate their life to this stuff, I really realized that, like, these mechanisms that are happening within the body are so unbelievably fascinating. And if we just learn how they work and we learn to use, understand what drives these mechanisms within the body, and we use them as tools within our toolbox, we become heavily armed with the ability to do different things. Because absolutely, is there a time where intermittent fasting works amazingly well? 100%. I love it. Is there a time where keto probably works amazingly well? Probably a time for everybody where it could work amazingly well. And with information at our fingertips, we have two options. We can have it paralyze us and have us just go pigeonholed into one direction, or we can absorb it all as much as we can with an open mind and have the ability to do really awesome things. Like, yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code program.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
If I could learn, if I knew 10 years ago that there were specific times where, like, oh, I know now that I feel good after eating XYZ. I can't explain to you why. I don't know why. Maybe it's microbiome. Maybe it's, we don't know. I mean, who are we to think that, like, we know everything about our friggin' bodies? Right. Like, seriously, we don't shit. Yeah. Like, what we have, like, human beings conducting research with technology that we have today. 300, 400 years from now, we're going to know new shit about our bodies that we never would have even imagined possible today. So our job is to take what we know now and know what works for us at a bio-individual level and apply it within our arsenal. If you feel good and you perform good and your biomarkers look good eating American cheese and Vienna sausage, then fucking go for it.
I agree. I totally agree. I think it is wild, too, that the two areas we know least about in the body, the microbiome and the brain, are communicating with each other.
Yeah, right.
Like, there's an interaction there that we don't really understand at all.
Yeah.
And, I mean, who knows how we keep affecting these things with the shit we're putting into them and what can pass the blood-brain barrier. And then the hormones that are occurring in the brain that we can't even really study because we can't really cut the brain open until the person's dead. Yeah. And then none of that stuff's yeah. firing. And it's like, you can't always see that on a CAT scan. You yeah. know what I mean? Like, these things are still hidden to us to some degree.
Dude, it's so, you know, and I'm going to bring this up because I know, you know, you were just on Joe Rogan, and I know he's big into this world, so it's relevant to even talk about it, but like adaptogens, right? Like, one could misconstrue adaptogens like, you know, adaptogenic compounds, like, let's just say, you know, for sake of just, you know, high dose lion's mane, things like that. Some people go the psilocybin route, whatever. Okay. But if you look at that, if you look at like the 1950s research of like general adaptation system in the body, we have a stress response, and then there is an acute like response to that stress where adrenaline, all that stuff goes up. And then there's the resolution phase where your body like adapts. And then there's an exhaustion phase where if you push it too far, your body gets so overly stressed out. Still kind of that hormetic curve. The reason I bring this up is like when we look at like the ability of our body to adapt and change to things, kind of nerding out on this because I've just been reading research on it. It's so wild, like how adaptogens work. If you look at the mice studies, because we can do these kind of studies in mice, you can't do them in humans, like similar to like you can't cut open a person's brain while they're alive.
Yeah.
You can do an fMRI scan and it can tell you a little bit. But with a mouse, you can, I mean, as messed up as it sounds,
you can control all variables.
Yeah, you can control variables. You can torture them. You can stress them. You can whatever, you know, and like you look at the data, like, okay, when you have mice that are forced to swim, they will swim until about 3 minutes until they give up, right? If you give them adaptogenic compounds, in this particular case, it was like Eulerococcus, it was like Schizandra, some of these other like well-known adaptogenic compounds at very high doses, 22 minutes.
Whoa!
And it's like, okay, that's not ergogenic, that's purely adaptogenic, and all that was doing. And then they look at their heat shock protein levels. Are you familiar with heat shock proteins?
No.
Okay, so like you look at like Rhonda Patrick's research and stuff like that. It's pretty, like heat shock proteins elevate when we exercise. They're it's called a chaperone protein. Basically, when we are going through heat stress through exercise or a sauna or anything like that, obviously heat is a stressor, so our cells go through this sort of folding and unfolding, and you can have these clumpings of different proteins that are inside your cell. The way it was explained to me, that makes a lot of sense. If you had a balloon and that balloon was filled with air, and you had low power magnets that were floating around in the balloon, and then all of a sudden you let the air out of the balloon, those magnets would like clump together.
Yeah.
They're not supposed to clump together, right? So what these chaperone proteins do is they like act as like little pieces of rubber that are in there to prevent those from like clumping.
Okay.
So you have that happening in your cell. And when you're exposed to high heat, like sauna, stuff like that, yeah, you build resiliency because you improve these HSP, you know, heat shock proteins. So it also happens when we're exercising. Well, they're found like with adaptogens, that's what was going on. So they're having, that's just one unit that they measured,
that
right?
That was building
so,
those.
Like a typical stress response would be like 3.2 PG per ml. Then like you look at like general bout of exercise is going to be like 5.5 to 6 PG per ml of HSPs. Literally just giving them adaptogens and then having them swim went up to like 15. So crazy adaptogenic response. And I'm not saying this as like advocating for any kind of adaptogens per se, but I'm saying like, okay, we are starting to learn that there is certain functions of different things within our body. And you look at the world of people that are looking at a lot of the research of like psilocybin and some of these even microdose things, it's fascinating research. Yeah. A lot of it can't make the mainstream because of obvious reasons, but it's telling us like what our brain is actually capable of and how our brain is driving pretty much everything.
Are these things that the adaptogens, can you look at them in people, or is it happening only in the brain?
Yeah, you can look at them in people. You know, there's a few human clinicals, like when you look again at Eulerococcus and you look at like some Schizandra, there's some like clinical studies. There's a meta-analysis of like 35 studies. I think it was like 6,000 people. They looked at people under, but it's all very anecdotal because they, when you're looking at like that many people, so like people in extremely stressful situations, ranging from temporary deafness, like where they would like just cut out, or if they had a disease or something where they would go deaf, and obviously it's a stressful situation. Mountain rescue, deep sea, like diving emergencies, like when things go wrong and they're measuring, they found that yes, when adaptogens were involved, their response to stress was much, much better. And overall, if you look at like the mice studies too, you see their resiliency, their baseline is elevated. If their stress response is a 1 at the beginning, and then you shock them or give them a stressor and it bounces up to 5, and then it comes back down, if they were not using adaptogenic compounds, it might come back down to just a 1 again, or maybe a 1.1. They get a little stronger, but using adaptogens, it would come down to like a 2. You know, right. They'd get stronger. Their baseline would get better. And again, I know Joe talks about this kind of stuff all the time. It's just, it's very fascinating. And up until like the last year, I kind of just brushed it off because I just wasn't interested. And that's kind of like what I do with my content, is a lot of it is driven by what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
And now I'm starting to get really damn interested in that, because again, in working with the military, I've seen like they, it's the brain. Like we were reaching somewhat of a limit in some ways with what we know with our physical body, with at least what we know right now. And if you look at sort of the hockey stick of all these different achievements that were happening even 20, 30 years ago, right? Like, you know, going into the Tony Hawk doing a 1080, and then all of a sudden everyone else is doing a 1080. And yeah, like we had this big uptick, and now some of that stuff's slowing down. Like maybe our physical bodies are starting to flatline a little bit. So now we got to start looking at, okay, well, how do we override that with the brain? And the whole reason I went down this rabbit hole is because that gut brain axis is the most insane thing. That like when you look at the communication and the vagus nerve, that, you know, 80% of the nerve cells that are in our vagus nerve are traveling from the gut to the brain. Yeah. And only 20% are traveling from the brain to the gut.
Yeah.
So what does that tell us? It tells us that 80% of the signal that's even involved in that enteric system is gut communicating to the brain. The other 20% might be the, you know, you know when you're driving down the road and you're going a little too fast and the highway and you see a highway patrol car and you get that like pit in your stomach all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably that signal. Brain triggers gastrointestinal response.
Right.
It's
but,
so nuts.
But, I mean, it's fucking fascinating. It's so that wild. There's a whole universe, literally, to study that we really don't understand at all. But something's happening.
Yeah.
There is some symbiosis there.
Oh, my gosh. Unbelievably. And now, like, there's even the skin microbiome. And now we're seeing, like, community, touching people, hugging, shaking hands, crossing that microbiome where you're actually, hey, I'm getting some of your microbiome, you're getting some of mine, and it's building that diversity. So we're ultimately creating this like unanimously healthy compilation of people.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably so inappropriate to talk about, but do you think, obviously neither of us are epidemiologists or
that's what makes this fun.
Scientists. Yeah. Right. Yeah, we're not total nerds, but do you think, because I think about this stuff and I don't know, but do you think that taking a year off from human contact is actually detrimental to some degree?
Yeah.
You know, and obviously there's something going around where we needed to do it, but like what are the ramifications of that going to be?
Yeah,
it's going to be something, I think.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously the mental piece, obviously the dependency on mobile device, the dependency on that is obviously going to change something. I mean, there's a lot of secondary things, but I think just for the nature of this conversation, the literal human contact, you know, not touching people, not that is changing something.
Yeah.
And I think that we're going to see a lot of research coming out on that, because I know a lot of people have jumped on that to really take a look at it, because isolation is very interesting. Like to some degree, isolation can help you. But again, just like everything else, you know, it allows you to catch your own thoughts. But no one is just, it's not like we were just isolated, getting to sit in a comfortable beach. Most of us were isolated with screaming toddlers and, you know.
So and stress. How are we going to make it through this?
Yeah.
Right.
And just uncertainty.
Where are we going to get toilet paper?
That's a huge driver, right? Yeah. So, but the skin microbiome piece and like touching people, and there's studies on like even like sexual activity and how it changes between partners, like how like maybe some of the drive and like serotonin and dopamine that changes when two people have sex is actually a result somewhat of the microbiome transfer too, which is just, it's just fascinating, man. It's just, we have more bacteria in our gut than we do cells in our body.
Yeah.
So clearly those little fuckers are doing something.
There's more of them than there is of us.
Yes, absolutely.
That's a weird thought, man. Yeah.
It's so crazy. And yeah, it's just, it's so hard to research it. And another thing that's been really wild is when you look at, okay, so in the younger population, they say gut diversity is important. And it's very clear for them to say that. Again, they say that as a blanket statement, and they're very clear on that. Like, we don't know which strains are good, so let's just say have an equal amount of all, and you have the best chance of success.
Sure.
But one thing they did notice is that in older populations, like in people in their 80s and 90s, they found that diversity isn't necessarily as important. What was more important was uniqueness, and I found this fascinating. So by uniqueness, they meant like the healthier people were people that had very like anomaly bacteria. So like if Bob is 90 years old and he had like let's say XYZ strain, Mary is 90 years old and she has a bunch of ABC strain, Tim is 90 years old, he's doing well, and he has a bunch of QRS strain. The uniqueness is what drives the best outcome in terms of their health. And what they've concluded with that, at least somewhat, is that, okay, what that means is that if these people are living a healthy life at an old age, they have a unique biome because their microbiome has adapted in ways to compensate for their weaknesses as an individual.
Right.
So as we're younger and we're generally healthy, diversity is best. But as we get older, you actually don't want diversity. You want a skewed result, not knowing which one you actually want. But you want a heightened result, you know, of XYZ bacteria in this person. You want uniqueness because that indicates their microbiome is adapting and changing and offsetting whatever poor thing is going on in their body, which again is like telling us so much that this bacteria, we need to be taking care of it because it is driving compensatory effects within our body as we age.
Yeah, there's no evidence, and I don't say this totally seriously, but I do think whenever I think about the microbiome, I think that's the UFOs. That's what they left us. That's what they've given us.
Yeah, right?
These are the aliens.
Dude, that's a good point.
You know, I mean, I say that slightly as an absurdist, but like, you know, it's so wild that there's more of them than there are of us, that they're having a huge influence on us and that we don't understand them at all. It's this thing we can't see. It's in every person. It's around us. It's inside of us. It's wild, dude.
Yeah, dude, it's so unreal. And I think we're centuries away from understanding, you know, it to a degree where it could actually help us.
Yeah, but how cool would it be if we discovered the type of uniqueness that would best suit each person, and then the way to make that thrive?
Yeah, you know, like, totally, man. Well, have you seen the research on, or just anyone talk about Veillonella before?
Uh-uh.
Okay, that's a bacteria that is in, they found in marathon runners. They're like, why are these marathon runners all like after long runs having this huge elevation in this particular strain of bacteria? And they realized, okay, well, this Veillonella feeds on lactate. So when athletes are working at an extreme intensity, they are producing a lot of lactate and it's feeding this one strain of bacteria. Okay, that's great. So what they did is they said, okay, let's take this Veillonella and let's put it into mice and let's extract it from the humans, put it into mice. They put it into the mice and all of a sudden the mice became extraordinary athletes.
Right.
Like, what the hell?
Can I have some?
Yeah, that's exactly what I said.
Can I have a Veillonella pill?
Yeah.
Are they developing this? You should develop this.
I think it's in some strains already, but that's the caveat, right? Is it feeds on lactate. So unless you're busting your ass training, you're not going to support that bacteria.
Right. Well, they got to make a prebiotic of lactate and a probiotic of Veillonella. And you take it as like a double whammy dose every morning, and then you can run a lot.
Yeah, there you go. Who cares about anything else? You'd be the most unhealthy person in the world, but you can run a lot.
You can run a lot. Yeah. That's it.
And it's just intriguing. I mean, I love going down that rabbit hole because it is like a sci-fi movie. It's so, and you have to always preface it with like, okay, none of this really matters yet.
Right.
But it matters in the
Or
sense.
Maybe it's the most important thing.
Yeah,
we don't
exactly,
know.
Exactly. Right?
You know? I think it's a real wild time to be alive. And while I get down sometimes about the landscape of Western diet, I also think what an interesting time. No other time has the populace en masse been able to sit back and think as much about what they eat. And you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
There's always been such scarcity. And now it's like, holy shit, we've got a lot. We've got an abundance. How do we use it? What's the best way to use it?
Totally. It can paralyze us or we can use it.
Right.
You know, that's entirely up to us. And it's the beauty and the curse of the internet too, is, you know, everyone has a voice, which can be a little bit rough sometimes, but it also allows us to, you know, absorb a lot, good, bad, and ugly, and, you know, come to a better consensus for us as individuals.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. Thomas, thank you so much.
Dude, thank you, man. Always a pleasure.
And now for the Q&A.
Here is a question for you from someone named Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Jeff says... he says, it seems to be the norm that the majority of people who have a struggle with weight loss or body image always have a negative self-image. No matter how fit or not fit they may be, they tend to see themselves in a negative way. Then he says, this is not the case for me. I've struggled with my weight my whole life, but I always felt good. He says, it's only when I actually look in the mirror that I'm reminded otherwise. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah. Well, I just talked to a comedian who I love named Stavros Halkias.
Halkias.
He's just Stavi, baby. You know, I know him as Stavi, baby. And then I always think of Stavi.biz because that's where his fantastic calendar is. But like, he doesn't have a negative self-image. I don't even think he has a negative self-image when he looks in the mirror. You know, he's like, he's like fucking feeling himself. And then starts, is dieting for comfort because he wants to be more physically comfort, which is fine. And, yeah, I don't know. I don't think, you know, I always thought of Jack Black as a guy who like had, who was super positive about himself, who would take his shirt off and stuff like that. And then I even saw like he was doing a diet. So I don't think it has to be an absolute truth that anybody who is quote unquote overweight or anybody who wants to lose weight has super negative self images. And then I think it's real interesting what Jeff was saying, that he doesn't feel down on himself, but then he looks in the mirror and he does. So there are moments of that. It sounds like, I just think, you know, even with like total narcissists, there've got to be times where they're like, you know, I heard about Jennifer Lopez. I don't know how true this is, but I heard that, and this is 20 plus years ago, a day on a movie was shut down because she was having a bad hair day. And I go like, Jennifer Lopez, it's got to be one of the most self-confident people on earth. I don't know if that's true or not. That's my perception of her. I don't think I've actually ever met her before. And then like she can wake up and look in the mirror and go like, fuck, this is a disaster. My hair is a disaster. We can't work today. Like we're going to shut everything down. So I think this idea of negative self-image is, I think it must affect everyone. I think, you know, supermodels probably feel that they don't look good sometimes. And then obviously for people who have real issues with this, it's just more of a constant where, there are a lot of reminders, you know, getting out of breath, walking up three stairs, and you're like, oh yes. And also I look terrible because this is reminding me that I'm massively overweight and out of shape and have no good, my cardio sucks. Or just like, God, you know, I didn't need assistance getting up those three stairs. I mean, there's a bright side, like I'm 500 pounds and I made it up three stairs by myself. Okay. I'm out of breath, but like I did it. I'm not in a wheelchair. You know, I mean, I think that there's a glass half full, glass half empty aspect to this. But like if you're going around feeling good and only having momentary reminders of like not feeling good, I don't think you I think the more we can feel good about ourselves, the better. So that's awesome.
Love it.
No, I don't know. Was there a question? Did I answer his question? I don't
know. Yeah. He, you know, he's just basically saying he does, from what I got from this, that he doesn't feel that way. You know, what were your thoughts on it? Basically, he just says it's only when he looks in the mirror, but he doesn't walk around feeling super upset about it all the time.
Yeah. That's great, man. I think that's awesome. And, you know, like, do we really need to look in the mirror all that often? Check our face for boogers and like make sure there's no sleep in our eyes in the morning. But like, I don't even need a mirror to brush my teeth. So like the actual necessities of having a mirror are not even there.
Right.
Yeah. Fuck the mirror. Let's all sit Shiva for the rest of our lives and cover the mirror.
Cover the mirrors.
yeah. I think that's great.
Love it.
I think if the better we can feel about ourselves, I think it's only a benefit. Thank you for your question. If you have a question that you want me to discuss, my fucking ridiculously verbose and overly significant ideas on this episode about, please submit it to AmericanGlutton.net.
Thanks for listening to this episode of American Glutton. I'm Ethan Suplee, and as always, joined by my chaperone, Paige Dorian. Follow us on Instagram at American Glutton Podcast. Sincerely.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.